All right. Well, about 3 months ago, I taught on Galatians chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. And I made a claim that the book of Galatians ought to be viewed as a blanket rather than a quilt. My point in doing that is, what the difference between a blanket and a quilt. A quilt has individual little pieces that are fastened together, right? Whereas a blanket is a bunch of threads, just all one piece. So you have these individual fabrics that are fastened together in a quilt, right? So they're just individual, but they get brought together to make one thing. And that's a lot of times how we come to Scripture. You know, we go in our quiet time, we look at our little section, and we really are thinking about what our section has to say, which is a good thing. But it can be tempting not to really think about what the rest, what has been leading up to this moment, how the author has set up for what he's about to say. And Paul, specifically in Galatians, I've noticed, does a brilliant job, obviously guided by God's wisdom, in putting together, piecing together, I guess weaving together, this blanket of Galatians. And so we have these threads that Paul just kind of weaves in and out, and we see it for a little bit, and then it goes away. And then there are certain parts where it becomes really prominent. Today we do have a specific, what I would have identified as maybe a theme that Paul introduces throughout the book, but gets special prominence. Paul talks about this dichotomy between the flesh and the spirit. And this has actually been introduced already, and I'm going to walk you guys through that. I'm going to point out how Paul has already introduced this, but then we're going to get into our passage about the fruit of the Spirit. But in order to get there, we need to remember what the whole blanket is about, or the illustration breaks down eventually, but what the letter's about. If we want to think about this thread and how it fits in, we need to zoom out and just remember, well, what is Paul writing Galatians for? Why does Galatians exist? Paul gets report of the Galatian church that there are Judaizers that are convincing them to return to Judaism, in a sense. Or at least to, as they would maybe put it, be Christian by being Jewish. Or, you know, you would have to observe the Sabbath, other laws, food laws, you'd have to be circumcised. As Paul hears this report, he gets really worked up, and he writes this letter to the Galatians. We've talked about this idea of putting on the sweatshirt, right? So the idea is they're identifying with a team that's not the right team. A while back, Pastor Todd talked about imagine a person comes, moves to Kansas City for a while, they catch the fire for the Chiefs, and then they end up going back home, and they're back home in Denver, and he so affectionately called it the donkey jersey that they would put back on. This illustration was given in order to talk about kind of what the Galatians are going through. They all have grown up, at least for the Jews, they've grown up in this Jewish context. For the Greeks, they're coming to what seems to be an offshoot of the Jewish religion. There's the old ways of doing things, which is trying to appease God through the law, right? Doing works in order to fulfill what God has for them. But now that Christ has come, it's by faith alone that we are saved. And so when people start to go back to these works-based religion, Paul is recognizing what they're really doing. They're turning away from the true gospel. And so Paul has to remind them what the true gospel is, that it's by faith alone that we're saved. But in turning away from this gospel, they're also naturally re-erecting walls that were built, that were torn down by Christ, right? Walls between Jew and Gentile. And that's another thing. There's this fellowship aspect that starts to break down too. So Paul becomes zealous for the gospel, and he becomes zealous for the church, which is falling apart because of what these people are teaching. Specifically, how this section fits into all of that, I've labeled my message, "The Fruit of the Spirit is Fellowship." And I'll get into why I called it that. But my, I guess, summary sentence of how I kind of see this passage unfolding is that when God fills his people with his Spirit, and that his people submit to that Spirit, we can expect one thing for certain: fellowship in his body. That is for certain. And that's a common thread that I see throughout here, and I'll get into that. But first, let's see this thread that Paul has been tracing through the letter as he set up this idea of the flesh versus the Spirit, how they're in opposition to one another, it's one or the other. So Paul begins introducing this in chapter 3. So Paul's laying out his argument, right? He greets them. He tells them his own three-part saga about his story. This gospel is not from man. It's from God. And then he gets into his argument. It's by faith alone that we're saved. And so he starts to put out all these arguments for why we should be compelled to believe that it's by faith alone that we're saved and not works. And so in chapter 3, verse 2, he reminds them of their beginning. He reminds them, hey, remember that time when you heard that message called the gospel? And do you remember what happened? You received the Spirit. And so here in verse 2, chapter 3, verse 2, he says, let me ask you this. Did you receive the Spirit by works of the law or by hearing with faith? Are you so foolish? Having begun by the Spirit, are you now being perfected by the flesh? Did you suffer so many things in vain, if indeed it was in vain? He who supplies the Spirit to you works miracles among you, or does he, who supplies the Spirit to you and works miracles among you, do so by works of the law or by hearing with faith? So we see here Paul starts to talk about, remember your beginning. You heard this message by faith, and you received the Spirit without any works of the law, right? You heard it, you had faith, and you received the Spirit. So it would be foolish then to have begun by the Spirit than to expect that the rest of this is going to be completed by your flesh, right? Stick with what actually got you on the right track, right? Stick with the Spirit. Later, Paul keeps doing his arguments. But later in chapter 4, Paul also reminds them again about their beginning, but this time about how they received the gospel, right? So Paul talks about, remember when I arrived and the reason I ended up teaching you the gospel is because of a bodily ailment, right? And normally in that culture, if someone had a bodily ailment, that was telling of what, if their message meant anything, right? If someone had a bodily ailment, then they probably wouldn't be respected as a prophet very much. You would need to be impressive in order to be heard. But the Galatians, when Paul comes to them, they look past Paul's fleshly ailment and they listen to what his spiritual message is. And he says that they even received him as an angel, as like a spiritual being almost, as if like a spiritual being came and said, this is the gospel. They looked past his fleshly ailments, and they were even willing to sacrifice their own flesh. He says that they would have even gouged out their own eyes for the sake of this spiritual message. And then he gets into Sarah and Hagar, and he talks about the child of promise versus the child of the flesh, right? He uses this, and he says that this can be interpreted allegorically for what their situation is. And he says, do you remember how Ishmael, which is who he describes as the child of flesh, how he persecuted Isaac in that story? He says, This is how it always is. The one that's born of the flesh is going to be persecuting the one that's born of the Spirit. And that's why you're persecuted for believing in the faith. And so we see he's already set up this dichotomy of flesh versus spirit throughout the book. He gets into chapter 5 and talks about freedom. And he says, through the Spirit we, by faith, ourselves eagerly wait for the hope of righteousness. And then if you jump down in verse 13 of chapter 5, he says, for you are called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh. And so again, we see spirit and flesh involved in this freedom, and that's actually a good setup for what he's about to talk about, which is the works of the flesh are this, the fruit of the Spirit is this. And so now we're here to chapter 5. My specific passage is the fruit of the Spirit, verse 22 and on. Last week we talked about, in more depth, the opposite list. I guess if you want to talk about where it starts, it's always hard to tell where it starts with Paul, because if things are weaving together, you never really know. But verse 16 is, I guess, where the ESV thinks it starts. He says, but I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, for these are opposed to each other, to keep you from doing the things you want to do. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. And then he gets into the contrary lists. And so it's pretty simple what he's saying. He's saying he's really telling them to do one thing, right? Live by the Spirit, walk by the Spirit, live according with the Spirit. But by doing that, they're also inherently not submitting to the flesh, right? So in doing one, you're not doing the other. That's like the flip side of a coin, right? If I'm flipping a coin and it lands on heads, it's also not landing on tails. If it's heads up, it's also tails down. So it's the flip side of the coin. If we are living by the Spirit, we are also at the same time naturally denying or not gratifying the desires of our flesh. And so we see them in opposition to one another. It's like a one-to-one. So as I'm reading the fruit of the Spirit, I notice 5 things that I'd like to point out to you guys. First of all, the use of an image of fruit. Paul chooses to use the image of fruit. It's not actually original. He doesn't necessarily come up with, he's not the first to ever do this, to use a fruit image, a tree image. I like to actually think of it as I'm talking about Paul weaving together this. It's almost like Paul goes to his favorite blanket and pulls out a thread and then decides to work that into his own blanket, right? What Paul does, if you are familiar with the Old Testament, you'll see a lot of tree, fruit, fruitfulness, imagery throughout the whole Old Testament. And as Paul is saturated in this, and I guess as Jesus was saturated in this, he also would use tree, fruit imagery. So Paul, going to Old Testament and also knowing the teachings of Jesus, he takes a thread from his favorite blanket and then he weaves it in. And so Paul chooses to use this idea of fruit. The other thing I would point out also is that it's fruit, not fruits. Notice that he says the works of the flesh are, and then in our list, we have the fruit of the Spirit is. So we notice that Paul not only chooses to use an image of fruit, but he chooses to use a singular image, right? But it's weird because then after that, he gives a list of multiple things. And so I've always been tempted when I refer to this passage, I say fruits a lot on accident. I have to catch myself. As I was studying, I heard different views about why he did this. And I think the most compelling was that it's almost in contrast to the gifts of the Spirit, right? And it talks about how people are gifted by the Spirit in different ways. And, you know, I might not, you know, have all the gifts of the Spirit, right? I might be hospitable, but I might not be a really good teacher of the Word, or vice versa, whatever. The Spirit gifts us in different ways, right? But when we come to this list, we actually have, I guess if you think of it this way, a one fully formed, fully developed fruit, a singular fruit. In other words, all of these ought to be present if the Spirit's at work in your life, right? None should be absent. You know, if I started to describe the fruit of the apple tree is red and seeded and whatever, and I start to, you know, if I said, so go grab me an apple, and they bring back, and I'm like, no, that's a pomegranate. You know, it's red. Yeah. So Paul, it's not a comprehensive list, but he lays out a list of things that describe the fruit, the one thing that the Spirit does in his people. God, when God works, he works in consistent ways. And so he will produce all of these at once. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And against such things there is no law. So we can remember throughout the Old Testament different times that they've used this tree imagery. One that really comes to mind, that would normally come to mind right away, would be Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away, and so forth. How often have you been standing under a tree and just thought, wow, like this is what human flourishing is like? I don't think of trees very often. But in Hebrew thought, Hebrew poetry and whatnot, trees were pretty significant to their way of life and living, right? It was significant. Trees were a big part of survival, in a sense. And even in part of the way that Jews think of how history has unfolded, starting in a garden with fruit trees and fruitful humans and choosing the wrong tree, and that just starts to develop throughout Scripture. And then Jesus hops on and he talks about how in Matthew 7, how you can tell a tree by its fruit, right? And he's talking about humans. He's describing them as trees. You can tell what type of human you're dealing with by the way, by the fruits that they're producing, right? Or in other words, by the works that they're doing. And so Paul jumps on the bandwagon with the fruit imagery. He jumps in, he weaves in his favorite thread. And he says, the fruit of the Spirit, one fully formed fruit. I also notice the source of the fruit. This is number three for what I'm noticing. That he says, walk by the Spirit and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit. He also says in verse 25, if we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. So we see Paul chooses to use fruit, singular fruit. And as he's thinking about this, he's reminding them of how we produce this fruit. So it only makes sense we would want to know, I want these qualities in my life. I want this fruit in my life. Where do I go for it? Because it's not mustering up enough ability in order to do this. It's not something that we can truly muster up. Sure, we can maybe try to be more loving, more joyous, have more peace and patience and kindness and goodness. We can maybe work at it, and maybe we can at least externally put up a front that maybe seems similar. But if we are wanting to actually experience the fruit, we have to go to the Spirit. Well, we have to go to God, right? Turn with me to John chapter 15. As we're thinking about the source of our fruit, it's only appropriate to go to where Jesus refers to himself as the vine. Jesus says in John chapter 15, I am the vine, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself, unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers. And the branches are gathered and thrown down to the fire and burned. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father loved me, so I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. And if you jump down to verse 16, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it. These things I command to you, so that you will love one another. And what's the first thing that we see as the fruit of the Spirit is love, right? Love. And he says, love one another. So Jesus has in mind in his discourse about himself being the vine, he's thinking about how that works with one another. And I think actually Paul has this in mind as well. I notice as I look at these two contending ways of life, the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, I notice that what comes from the fruit naturally is unity, and what comes from the works of the flesh is disunity or illegitimate unity. So if you look at the lists, notice sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. Notice divisions, dissensions, envy. We see a lot of disunity, a whole lot of things that just naturally will divide people, right? And that's actually what these Judaizers are doing, right? They're putting up divisions that the gospel has torn down. And then we also see unity, but illegitimate unity, right? In these sexual sins and in idolatry, I'm sure people are unifying around an idol. These are illegitimate ways of unity. But when you look at the fruit of the Spirit, we see love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. These things naturally lend themselves towards unity, towards fellowship. How can we love if there's no other people around, right? How can we have patience? You know, if I said, I'm a really patient person as long as you leave me alone. Right? As long as you don't annoy me. I'm a really loving person when I'm by myself. You know, these just don't work without other people. They actually, and peace, you know, the image of peace is you know, reconciling with one another, right? It's like the opposite of war, peace, coming to a treaty. It's not necessarily like you're sitting and you're just, oh, peace, you know, right? I mean, I guess. But with one another, we have peace with one another, joy together. I guess the only one you can maybe argue is that you could have joy alone. I think of it this way, though. When I am watching, say, a comedy, I laugh a lot louder with friends. Joy is much more enjoyed with other people when you are enjoying together. I really do think that Paul has fellowship at the front of his mind when he's thinking about the writing about the fruit of the Spirit and encouraging this church and how they should live, how they should turn away from what these Judaizers are telling them to do. And as he's encouraging them, how they're supposed to live, how they're supposed to live free. And here is what Paul says. He says, you're free, but he says, don't use that freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, right? So the common objection to Paul's gospel presentation, that's by faith alone, is that, well, people will just use that kind of freedom to do whatever they want. They'll just be sinful. And Paul speaks to that and he says, don't use your freedom foolishly. Don't use your freedom as an opportunity for flesh. But use your freedom and then be free, right? But through love, serve one another. That's what Paul sees as the natural way to go when you are set free by Christ, is to love one another. And so Paul gives us what our lives ought to look like as the church body. We're in fellowship season. We have these seasons here at MCC, if you're not familiar, and we're specifically thinking about fellowship. And I think it's only appropriate that we'd be thinking about what our fellowship ought to look like as a church in reading through the fruit of the Spirit. So I noticed Paul gave this image of fruit. He calls it singular, and I think that is because he expects all of these things to be present in this church. We go to the source of fruit. The source of the fruit, God, in his word, to his Spirit, to his Son. We have these lists that are opposite of the fruit, and then we have what the fruit are. And ultimately, if I was trying to boil it down, it would be the Spirit will produce fellowship in his people. When God fills his people with his Spirit, and his people submit to that Spirit, we can expect one thing for certain, and that's fellowship. And so as we think about how we ought to respond to this list, it'd be tempting to just try to start mustering up these things. And I do want us to, you know, it says, let us keep in step with the Spirit. So there's an effort involved in what we ought to be doing in keeping in step with the Spirit. But we can't let ourselves do the very thing that Paul is trying to warn the Galatian church against, which is to earn favor with God. We can't try to muster up these things so that we can have favor with God. We do these things because we have favor with God. We have faith that God is going to work these things into our lives. And so first off, I would encourage you from Romans chapter 8. Paul says, those who live according to their Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. I'd encourage you to go to Scripture in order to abide in the Spirit. Read his word. But most obviously in the text, through love, serve one another. This is what Paul says. But he says, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. And then he almost tags on three more that could maybe go on that list earlier. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another to anger, and envying one another. And so I encourage you, church, to go to the source for this fruit. Pray for this fruit in your life, in our life as a church. And then do it. Serve one another in love. Be loving and joyous and peaceful and patient and kind and good and faithful and gentle and have self-control. In this way, you'll be loving your neighbor and fulfilling the whole law, Paul says, and Jesus says. And so that's what I encourage you.